Okay, recording is on. Levels are still set. Well, so we should start. Can you tell me your name and what you do and where you come from?
Okay, my name's Neville Young. And I have been involved in astronomy for over 30 years now. I joined the Astronomy Society in Pretoria in October 1985. And as far as where I come from, born in South Africa, Durban specifically, traveled around the country quite a bit as a kid, and settled in Pretoria in about 1975, and joined the Astronomy Club in 1985, and besides for a few short excursions out of Pretoria, I'm still here in Pretoria and loving it.
What kind of line of work? I mean, we were talking about this just now before we started recording,
And I don't think we actually did get to really the nitty gritty. Electronics is my formal training. Computer sciences was very much part of it, and Packer Electronics in those days when we still knew how to use transistors. And ICs were the hot thing. The 74 series was really the hot thing at that stage. And I continued, or used those skills at the CSR, where the sort of main focus of research there was air pollution. So, of course, whenever you have research and equipment, you do need electronics support. But, of course, I did a lot more than electronics, and I got a lot more of a wide involvement in all sorts of things. For instance, with this air pollution research, I spent a lot of my time living in caravans on farmers' fields, flying weather balloons for, say, 6 weeks. And these were tethered weather balloons, not the kind that you release. So they would go up and down, 1,000 feet up and down, and I'd be taking readings every 50 feet or so, as it was in those days. And measuring temperatures and measuring wind directions and wind strengths.
Okay.
So I did go all over the place, which was a lovely education. And for a young guy who was in his very early 20s, it was a lovely way to learn some independence and how to look after yourself in the world. So I think that maybe answers your question. Of course, there may be things that I missed, which are obvious to me, which you would pick up.
Well, it sounds like you had some good skies while you were traveling. Were you always into astronomy?
I, at the age of about 10 or 11, and that was at the time when the first satellites were going up.
Okay.
And, of course, the Mercury missions were being launched at that stage. And so I was fascinated by that. And I do remember, and I doubt if I did this regularly, but I do remember on one occasion actually taking a blanket up on top of a little flat roof on the veranda in the house where we lived, and that was in the Strand, Somerset West. And getting up there to lie there and see how many satellites I could see and catch them going over. And of course, there weren't too many in those days. I guess that was maybe 1965.
Okay.
So there weren't too many then. So there was that interest then, and I presume, I suspect it stayed a latent interest all the way through until 1985, when I was visiting in the Kruger Park with family, and one evening I noticed a fellow out there on the lawn, and he had this telescope pointed at the sky, and I thought, oh, okay, what's this guy doing? And I wandered along and had a look at what he was doing. Oh, and he was impressing me with all sorts of things that he was doing, and showing me double stars and showing me how these double stars spin around each other. But I eventually realized that these double stars were sourced from a little bottle of vodka that he had next to him. And it took me some while to realize, Michael, you know, I'm not going to see things like that happening. And I think his little scope wasn't all that great either. So yeah, there was a lot of wobbling, and so it made it look as though things were sort of spinning around. So I really didn't know very much I wasn't very knowledgeable at astronomy as such. I was interested in the subject. So as soon as I got home, and also Halley was about to arrive.
Yes.
And so I looked in the AA Road Atlas, where I'd noticed before that there were contact details for the various astronomy centres around the country.
Mm.
And I did phone, and the man who was the contact person at that stage was Jack Bennett.
Right.
And Jack Bennett, of course, was one of the founding members of our astronomy club here in Pretoria.
Mm.
And I eventually managed to go to his house, and I knew that there was, at CBC, a telescope, which is the one that we know now, which does house a rather ancient 12-inch Newtonian. And at that stage, we still had our meetings at UNISA. So it wasn't a case of actually being at CBC and then knowing that the observatory was there. I just saw they said they had an observatory and it was at the school.
Did UNISA have the observatory? Yes. That was built fairly recently, wasn't it?
That observatory was built in about 19... And I can pretty well tell you when it was. Maybe 1992 or 3.
Okay.
Because... I had the so-called privilege and the awareness of getting old when I was invited to the 21st anniversary of the building of that observatory at UNISA, and the UNISA rector was there as well. So it was a fairly important function. And the guy who was presenting it was Professor Dirk Smits.
Yes.
Who I'm sure you know.
Mm.
And he did present a speech, and in one of the things that he said, and I think there's only one person in this room here this evening who was there at the opening of the observatory 21 years ago. Neville, would you stand? So, that did begin to show my age and my long-term involvement. And so, getting back to my introduction to astronomy, I managed to eventually get the key from Jack Bennett, to the observatory, and opened the door, and it was just cobwebs from the top to the bottom.
Right. This the CBC observatory?
The CBC observatory. Okay. And dust covered everything. There was a dust cover over the whole telescope, but still there was just dust everywhere. And the age group in the Astronomy Society at that stage, they were a bunch of guys who were possibly as old as I am now, but I don't think they were as active as perhaps I am now. I do think people, if I remember people in their 60s, when I was in my 30s, they were an old bunch of guys. But now that I'm in my 60s, I actually feel quite fit and strong.
Well, you say that. I remember something similar at the Natal Midlands Centre, which was a few years later, about the late 90s. I was in high school and I used to go there. And I had the same impression. It was this old bunch of people, and there I was, this kid. I mean, of course, I think, looking back now, they were probably from their early 40s onwards, so now that doesn't seem old to me at all, because that is me.
Not at all. And I can remember at one of the first meetings, it may have been the first or the second meeting that I attended at UNISA, there was a youngster, and he was in his final year of school, but he was absolutely fascinated with astronomy, and he'd taken photographs and he'd been observing and making notes. And one of the older members in the club had actually noticed this young fellow sitting next to him and had all these notes, and he was most impressed by this, and he actually got up and he said to everybody, look what this young guy's been doing. And that young guy's name was Moritz Heisse, and 2 weeks ago he visited me here in my observatory.
All right.
He lives in the Strand, Somerset West, so we've kept contact ever since then. But he's about to turn 50 in January.
Wow.
So time has flown.
Yeah.
So I did get some friends together, and we went in there with buckets of sunlight soap and mops and feather dusters, and we spent a whole weekend cleaning out that observatory. And then it was a case of, with my sort of limited knowledge at that stage, busy trying to get the telescope working again. There wasn't really too much that was broken as such, but it wasn't all that easy to use. It's a fairly, it's about a 3 meter focal length.
Oh.
I don't know if you've seen it before. Very often is it open these days, because the telescopes that we get these days are far more convenient to use, and on our Friday evening club evenings there, some people like to go and look in the observatory, but they look at the telescope and not through it.
Yeah.
And with that, you do have to climb a ladder to get quite high up. Mm. Your head would probably be about 2.5 meters above the ground when you're actually looking through the eyepiece. So in the dark, we've had public going up there, and you look after the public fairly carefully because you don't want them to fall off the ladder.
Yes.
So having got the observatory going, it came to the AGM in 1986, and at this AGM most of the older members had decided they needed to step down. And at the meeting was a Professor Vargo, who was in the Department of Mathematics at UNISA, but he was presenting the astronomy course there. And so he was at this meeting, and it was a case of now the typical AGM where suddenly everybody's looking around to find who's going to fill this post and who's going to fill this post. And why don't you do it? Why don't you? Yes, yes, come on, come on, come on. And of course, people make ill-considered decisions and say, okay, fine, I'll do it. And then 6 months later, they resign. You understand that scenario. So I happened to get roped into that committee and ended up as a secretary. And Professor Vargo was then chairman. And I was really expecting to get going, but not having known too many professors and not knowing how scatterbrained they are. And I can say this because Walter Vargo passed away a number of years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe most professors would understand if I said a lot of them are rather scatterbrained. And I was waiting for, when is this fellow going to call the inaugural meeting of the committee so we can get started in doing things? And then I eventually phoned him and said, look, we need to have a meeting. Oh, must we have a meeting? Okay. And then I began to realize that the position of secretary is pretty powerful in a society, and especially if you need to drive things, and by keeping decent minutes, you could actually have quite an impact on a society. So I stayed doing that for maybe 10 years before I moved on to various other portfolios within the club, and so gradually learned more about the subject, and so here I still am 30 years after having joined the club initially.
Right. When did you start with Star Waders?
Ah.
What is that?
Star Waders, you know, I began to work sort of for myself in about 1985. Mm. I went to work at the MultiChoice building, but rather for the company who was developing the DSTV system that we have in the country these days. And I went along there as a technical writer. And just to take a step or two back, in the electronics industry where I worked, I was finding, and particularly when I worked at Tuckey's for 2 years, and I was working in the mechanical engineering department as an assistant to the MechEng postgrads who were doing their PhDs and so on.
Yeah.
And I realized that a lot of these young M students were so sharp, and even though I was the electronics guy, and we would want to go and use, say, the 8052 basic chip, one of them would take the manual home and he'd come back the next day and he'd understood how to do this whole thing and he'd actually written software that we wanted.
8052, was that a processor?
It was a basic, there was the 8052, I think it was an assembly maybe, assembler, and then there was a basic version of the 8052.
Okay.
Yeah. So then I realized that, my golly, these guys were far too clever for me. But one thing that had always happened, particularly at the CSIR, is that I'd be chatting to sort of one of my academic colleagues, not necessarily related to work, and then as we'd be about to part, I would say, oh, by the way, and you've got a spelling mistake in your report over there. And he'd say, oh, won't you just read through it and check for them? So I would do that. And then in doing so, I would say to him, what on earth did you mean in this paragraph? What were you trying to say? And he said, oh, I didn't know how to say that. I said, why don't you say it like this? Oh, that sounds perfect. So that was the beginning of me realizing I did have some ability with documentation.
Right.
And so I did a fair amount of that. The news got around, so I ended up going through quite a lot of people's reports and research papers. And so when I went to Takis, I did end up writing a software manual for some of the pieces of software they were writing. I went to, from there, to an electronics company called Factum Electronics. And after about a year and a half, I'd heard for the whole day some of the senior members of staff in the boardroom talking away, quite animated. And I eventually, one of them came out there and he said, didn't you say something on your CV about writing? And I said, yes. And he said, won't you just please come in here into the boardroom? And he said, look, we are wanting to tender for a documentation project. And we've got these circuit diagrams over here, and we meant to write a description of the circuit here. We'd like a technical description, how the thing fits into the system, a general description. We've been trying all day to write it, and we don't know how to do it. And he said, the circuit does this and this and this. There are these inputs, there are those outputs. This IC in the middle does such and such. Could you explain that? So I wrote it up in half an hour, and he said, well, that's exactly what we want. So I managed that project for the next year and a half. And we did reverse engineering on a lot of circuitry and produced some very nice documentation, and eventually actually got the project to actually rebuild the boards completely. So that was really enjoyable. And for various reasons, I decided to leave there, and I thought, you know, let's make a career change.
Mm-hmm.
Let's actually go into writing as a technical writer. And I found a small little company and sort of did my, I suppose, what you call it, journeymanship there, and wrote manuals on how to manage Greyhound buses, how to clean the toilets in the Greyhound buses, how to manage the video system, how to drive the things, what the front panel looked like. I did various other interesting projects. One of them was cleaning SA Breweries' brewing tanks.
Okay.
These tanks are about 10, 15 meters deep and about 5 meters wide. And what they used to do to clean them was to lower a dinghy to the bottom and put two men in the bottom, one with an oar and the other one with a scrubbing brush. And the one would row around and the other one would scrub the walls.
And I suppose they'd slowly fill it as they...
And they'd slowly fill it until they got to the top. And this took them about a week to do that. And a company had developed a system where they lowered a device in through the manhole at the top and it unfolded once it got in there. And they then this thing turned and started from the top. And it turned a high-pressure hose on it, and in half a day, they'd clean the whole tank.
Mm-hmm.
So I ended up writing the technical documentation for that, and so I spent quite a few days right on the top of this tank and watching what was happening. So that was fascinating, and then getting the document translated into, I think it was Italian and Portuguese for their marketing in those countries. So I learned a lot at this little company, and after 3 years, I left there to go and write some of the manuals for the decoders that people were buying in 1995, and was there for the launch of the satellite in August 1995, and that's when the first DSTV satellite went up, and the service started shortly after that.
So these satellites are they owned by...
No, no. They are satellites launched by the United States, uh-huh. and you rent space okay. on these things. So you transmit your signals up to them, and they transpond the signals back down to the mm. dishes in all the homes.
Okay.
And I did that for a while there as a technical writer, but then eventually got more involved in more of the technology. Each of the decoders contains software, so I eventually ended up in there for the next 10 years managing the software mm-hmm. and the encryption.
Right.
Into all those decoders. And so, you know, there to a certain extent there was a documentation role. I wrote a documentation how to do all these processes, generated all the administrative documents mm-hmm. to distribute the software and get all the necessary authorizations and approvals on doing so.
Mm-hmm.
And when that ended up, the company, a lot of its sort of research, well, not necessarily research, but development, moved over to China. And the company is actually quite big in China now, the original company that was here in South Africa.
Right.
And so the Chinese were a lot cheaper.
Right.
So I had to go to China for 6 weeks and go and train the people up to do the job that I wasn't going to have anymore. And after that, and during that time when I was there as a contractor.
Mm-hmm.
For all those 10 years. The company subsequently moved to Holland. I began to look around here for work, and I did bits and pieces here and there, and in all that, gaining lots of experience, and all of it's contract-based work until this DSTV company called me in 2010, again having stopped mm-hmm. working for them in 2005, and said, look, we've got another technical administration project here. We need to manage some of these things. Can you do it from South Africa? So I did. So I did that. And I'm still doing that at the moment on a small basis. Mm-hmm. There's not too much work there, so it's a small project that I spend some of my time doing.
Okay.
So I think maybe your original question was the writing.
Oh, well, maybe. Star Waders specifically.
Oh, Star Waders, yes. Of course, yes. So, you know, what we did have when I was perhaps a bit out on a limb, having no longer having this reasonably full-time original work with this then Dutch company, I was wondering how else I could generate a living, and I, you know, really had lots of dreams about some astronomy endeavor, and just one day sitting outside in the lawn, and I thought, what kind of name could I have written? I am very aware of the fact that we live next to a star,
mm-hmm.
and we are very close to the star,
mm.
and we are not too close, and we are not too far away, but the closeness to me was analogous to the waves in the sea. And it's nice to paddle in the waves. It's nice and comfortable, but you don't want to go out too deep.
Right.
It can get a bit dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
And so I felt that we were wading in the shallow waters of the radiation from our local star.
All right, okay.
So that's why I decided that each one of us living on this planet are star waders.
Okay.
So that name I used, and not very much happened, but there is a CC registered in that name.
Mm-hmm.
And there have been the odd involvements, my book sort of being one of them, and the various educational products
yes.
that I've also built. So a lot of those have gone under the Star Waders name. So who knows, maybe one day the Star Waders name will become have a little bit more exposure worldwide.
I've seen some of these, well, you've shown that to me before, these, like your solar system models. How do they work again? Because I don't have one in front of me right now.
You know, I'd love a lot more, or many more, of those who have been involved in astronomy for many years to actually see how it works.
Right.
And the solar system model, I built it on with the idea in my own head, because in my own head I was also always trying to think, now, where is this? Why is Venus coming up there and then going, disappearing down there again? Why does it come up on the other side? And technically I knew why, mm-hmm. but I couldn't actually wrap it around in my head all that easily.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I wanted to do, and I'd spent a lot of time with our society going to malls, shopping centres, and I did end up doing a lot of the interaction with public and fielding their questions and trying to answer them. And what that reminded me of was when I was finishing school and you do your aptitude tests and they said, you've got to be a teacher. And I said, no ways am I going to be a teacher. I want to be an engineer. And I've come from a family of teachers and began to realize that genetically I couldn't really fight against it.
Right.
And the aptitude certainly came out in being able to talk to people. And in trying to explain to people what was happening, I would be using my arms and waving my arms around and realized I actually need some sort of model which would make it a lot easier to explain, not only to them, but for me, for my own idea. So I experimented in a garage and built various prototypes and eventually did make a model. And the whole way the model works is to allow the viewer, the member of public or the student, to look at the model. The model is orientated in such a way that its west is our west, its east is our east.
Okay.
There are the planets on the model, and the model is orientated in such a way that if I expanded it a zillion times, it would fill the space of the real solar system. And I have a little character who actually, a little model of a little person who stands actually on planet Earth and who looks up. And what this little person can see with the planets in the correct positions for that specific evening when I'm doing the demonstration, that little model person can see the same thing that the person standing, the human being can see standing in that same place.
Okay.
But what that human being can also see is the little man's big picture.
Right.
Which enables the human to understand where his big picture was.
Right.
And to understand why we see the planets moving the direction they do, why they retrograde, why Venus would disappear in our western sky and then pop up again later in the morning sky. Because that's one of the most popular questions, of course, is people say, which is the morning star?
Right.
It's really one of the most popular questions. So that is the point of view from where that model comes in. When there was a financial crunch in 2007-08, and you know, then again, I did battle to have work, find work, and so that's when I began to go from a prototype into a production model, and I'd love to have thought that the South African government would have said, "Oh, this is wonderful for our schools, for education, for lateral thinking, let's buy 60,000 of them." And of course that didn't happen. Mm-hmm. And there may be 50 of them in various schools where I'd met people and they bought them. And I know of one or two where they are still actually in use in classrooms. But I might be able to do a calculation one day and just wonder how many thousand people I've actually done presentations to.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, our Pretoria Astronomy Society is pretty active in outreach. So I've been involved in quite a lot of those as well. And what I've been fortunate to do as well these days is on a commercial but pocket money sort of basis is go and do presentations and show the stars at various events, conferences, and so I get paid to go out to lovely places like the Skukuza.
Okay.
And it's a long drive there and back for the night.
Mm-hmm.
And, but, so, you know, I've done this presentation to thousands of people, and I just love actually seeing the reaction, and especially the comment, "Oh, now I understand."
Right, yes.
I love that. So I really do like to get down to the man in the street. I don't want to impress him with numbers and figures and names, and I can tell him that star is called such and such, and that core star is called such and such. Well, I say, so what?
Yeah.
And what I like to do is if somebody's seen Saturn through, say, one of my colleagues' telescopes, and then I'd say, okay, you've seen Saturn. So what? It's pretty, mm-hmm. isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
It's a gasp. What's it doing there? And then they'd come along and look at the model. Mm-hmm. So I think people go away with a much broader understanding of what they were looking at. And it's my philosophy that if you understand what you are dealing with, you remember it a lot better.
Right, right. Okay. Are you able to explain the scale of the solar system with it? Like, for example, would you say if this was to scale, then this would actually be sitting in Johannesburg or something?
I most certainly do that, because that kind of orientation is essential for somebody to begin to understand what they're seeing. So when I do my introduction to the model and I explain that the nice equispaced orbits that are on the model are for practical purposes only, and that if I'd had to build the model on scale, I'd have had Mars 2 centimeters away from the Sun in the middle, with Neptune 75 centimeters away on the edge. So the planets are spread equally along the arms of the model. So what happens there with this model, the way that the little man actually sees what's up in the sky, I have a pointer, and the pointer I can point from him, and I can point it to in the direction of, say, Jupiter on his model, but you can follow that point and it points to the real Jupiter up in the real sky.
Okay.
So that's, even though the scale is not correct, the model still actually works.
Yeah.
And I do also mention to them that if that model was to scale as well, that the Sun in the center would be the size of a pea, and that Neptune on the outer hoop, 75 centimeters away, would actually fit into the hoop.
Right.
And then I normally just do a little illustration, and I get some interested looking person there to come and stand with their arms out wide, and I ask them to hold the earth, the Sun in the one hand and the palm of the one hand and the Sun in the palm of the other, and you know, say to them, okay, if they are that far apart, how big would they be? And the earth on that scale from one palm to the other would actually fit into a piece of 80 gram, a sheet of 80 gram paper. And, you know, this really opens people's minds, and then that's why I then would say to them, that's why it's called space. And I think what people are given the quite wrong idea with by the coffee table books, which of necessity have to put pictures of all the planets perhaps nicely in a row, and they tend to think that the solar system is filled up with planets. Whereas planets are almost the anomaly in space. They take up so little of the space, whereas our Sun takes up about contains about 99% more than that, 99.9% of the mass of the solar system. So we are the leftovers. Planets are the leftovers, the dregs of dust of what formed the solar system. So I love people to be able to have that grasp.
I heard a quote the other day where I forget who said it, otherwise I'd give their name, but they said there's a famous saying that nature abhors a vacuum, and because we know that's not true. The universe is a vacuum.
Yes.
With these little tiny little islands of stuff. Yeah.
I used to even say to some people that, tongue in cheek, that matter is a sickness of the universe, and that it pops out in acne from time to time on this beautiful swath of energy that the universe is. But you know, and of course, a lot of that brings us back to the situation and the comprehension that we are not necessarily anything special in the universe, and the progression from the days of when the Earth was the center of everything and the center of the solar system through to us becoming less and less and less significant in the big picture.
Yeah. Although there's one area where it's turned out we are a little unusual, which is just this. I mean, it's only recently we figured this out, realizing that our star is unusual. It's unusually large. Because the vast number of red dwarfs and smaller, which were simply invisible to us in the past, Now with these infrared survey telescopes, we're realizing stars our size and larger are quite rare.
Yes, I suppose in that...
I mean, there's still hundreds of millions or billions of them.
And there are, yeah.
And there's just one. More.
But all that we've done is just increased the database of stars that we've got to look at. And where we were only looking at the top bigger ones, we were actually finding out there were a whole lot more. And so we're in those top... bit bigger.
Well, I just mentioned that as something we can feel a little bit better about, you know.
Yeah. No, I don't have any problems. I just find being a living human being at a time when we can understand what's going on out there is just such an exciting experience.
And it's such a busy time now in astronomy. There's so much being found. I can't keep up anymore. You know, I started Urban Astronomer by rewriting other people's news articles and then trying to add a bit of insight of my own. And eventually it got to a point where it's hard to be curious for interesting facts when those interesting facts are coming at you like a fire hose. You know, it's almost an overload. So you wrote a book, I believe you were approached by a publisher to write that?
Yeah. There was a publisher who'd got the idea that there was perhaps a bit of a gap in the market. And this actually was in the Afrikaans market.
Mm-hmm.
It was an Afrikaans publisher called LAPA, who people may not know. LAPA stands for Lees Afrikaans, Praat Afrikaans.
Okay.
And the person there who believed that there was perhaps a gap in the market for the layman on the subject of astronomy had been asking around, and this person knew this person knew this person knew this person, until eventually somebody said, well, look, we've got this guy Neville in our club, and I know he writes for a living, maybe he'd be interested. And of course I was jumped at the opportunity and went and discussed it with them and said, fine, I'll go away and I'll just write something for you. And they came back and said, well, that's fine. So this was in 2010. So they gave me an advance to start writing the book, and a bit of a brief on how many pages roughly, but basically I had carte blanche on the content of the book. And of course they were not really into scientific publications. They aimed at crochet books, baking, cooking, and nice sweet love stories.
Right.
And so this was a bit of a departure for them from their standard fare that they produced. And so I think that's one of the reasons why they let me go ahead. And it took a year and a half of writing. Loved it. Was fortunately, having been in the astronomy circles for a number of years, had several friends who were able to read and advise me. And say, well, no, hold on, that's maybe not entirely true. Maybe you should just... But the work is pretty well my own. And initially, with what I've been saying about models, I want people to have a perspective on what they are seeing. Because as our minds have evolved to appreciate rocks and berries and trees that we can climb up if we have to, or a hill in the distance that we've got to go and climb over. Our minds have not evolved to comprehend a world where there's no up and down, and you're on a round, living on a round orb. And so to try and give people some means of comprehending that, in order to be able to look further.
Right.
And so my first working title for the book was A Perspective in Astronomy. But of course that...
It's a bit academic. Far too academic.
And the book was intended for the man in the street, for the layman. And then and one of the feelings I had as well is that the man in the street can do so much himself. He just doesn't realize that he can actually take a photograph. He can take his binoculars and see the moons of Jupiter.
Right.
The sky's not static. There are things that are happening out there. So I wanted the man in the street to be able to do that. So the next title that found its way into my head was Astronomy, Yes, You Can.
Mm-hmm.
But now this was in about 2010, and Obama was now seated in the presidency of the United States. And, of course, he'd gone into power on the theme of Yes, We Can.
Right.
And the publisher said to me, you know, we think that
but derivative.
Title, yes, and that looks as though you're trying to start a movement, maybe. So, can you think of something else? And in the shower one day, and the shower is a lovely place for getting inspiration.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought, Astronomy Within Reach.
Okay.
Because that's what I want it to be, mm-hmm. within reach of the man in the street. And knowing that the book was going to be published in Afrikaans as well,
mm.
I had to do a quick translation, and the translation just turned out to be beautiful alliteration, Sterk in de Binne Bereik.
Okay.
So there was that, and I presented that to them, and they said, that's fine. So that's the name of the books. They printed 5,000 copies, and extremely exciting and emotional when I got the first hard copy in my hand, and put the book into all the exclusive books and Kalahari.net. I don't know if it exists these days.
They've merged with Take a Lot now.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Okay. And bargain books and places like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it did very well. And even if I say so, myself, I'm very sort of proud of what the book has been able to do, and how I've bumped into people at events, not necessarily even astronomy events, and somebody says, are you the guy who wrote that book?
Right.
And when they tell me, oh, I loved the book,
mm-hmm.
it's such a rewarding thing to hear. And in fact, even yesterday, I received an order for the book because it's still available on a website,
mm-hmm.
an eponymously named website, which I should maybe just say means that the name of the website is the same as the name of the book.
Right, right. Well, we'll put a link to that in the show notes. So.
Okay.
Yeah.
And this guy, he sent me the email saying he's so-and-so and he's interested in the book. And his son is now getting involved in astronomy, and he'd love to buy the book for an astronomy. He says, because I bought the book at the Prior Grange B&B near Springfield in the Free State.
Okay.
A number of years ago.
Right.
And on a trip that I did through there one day, there's the lovely little mezzanine pub there, mm-hmm. and there's lots of books in the pub. And the owner of the Grange, of the B&B, had actually written a book himself on the activities in that area during the Boer War.
Mm.
And I said, I've also written a book. And I hold out my book, and he said, oh, that's nice. I said, okay, well, I'll swap you. One, I'll take one of yours, and you take one of mine. And he looked at mine, and then he said, no, I'll take 10 of yours, thank you. Not for one of his, of course.
Yeah.
And he paid me cash on the spot for 10 books.
Nice.
And now, isn't this amazing that 5 years later, here's a guy who says, I bought your book at Prior Grange, and I love it, and I want to now buy a copy for my son.
Yeah.
So very...
That's brilliant.
Very rewarding.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, so the book is no longer in print, but you say there are copies that they can get from you directly. You did mention from the website, with the link we'll put up. Yeah, so... Segways also are not my strong suite. That's fine. So speaking of books, we are in an observatory. So this is your observatory in your backyard. You think we were chatting earlier, you started building it about a year ago. So lovely little space in here, I must say. What is the basic design of it? How did you go about it?
There was a space in the garden. There was an old plum tree planted next to one of these old windy houses, garden shed typically. And I moved into this house nearly 3 years ago, 2.5 years ago. And what immediately struck me was here, for the first time in decades, I actually had a place where I could build an observatory. I'd been living in places where I didn't have the rights. I maybe didn't own the place, townhouse complex, lots of trees.
Mm.
And I really thought, now I can build an observatory. And I was quite amazed at the quality of the sky where I am, even though I'm in suburbia.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe one of the reasons the sky looked so fantastic to me was because I didn't have all these trees around and I could actually see so much of the sky, just about a 360-degree horizon above 20 degrees.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, okay, this is a project I'm going to start. And as I'm sure we all have, projects in our lives that we've started and then eventually mm-hmm. we haven't finished. And I thought, this is going to be one project I'm going to finish. So I turned the first sod on around about the 19th of December 2016 and planted a creosote pole. And then as I went, designed, I had a fair idea in my head of what I wanted. But a lot of it depended upon what materials you found when you went into Builder's Warehouse. Oh, right. That looks like the right kind of stuff. Uh-huh. I'll use that. And so then started the hard work, the hard physical work
mm-hmm.
of building the walls around it. And of course, it's in a home garden, so it must fit in nicely to the home garden. Yeah. So I think I've done that quite nicely, and wifey is very happy with what it looks like.
Mm-hmm.
And then trying to work out how do I want to make it an observatory? Do I want to have a dome, a slide-off roof? And I didn't want to have a dome for the reason that when I'm outside under the sky, I like to see the whole sky. I don't want to see just one little slit.
Right.
And so it was have to be that the whole roof would slide off. But then when a roof slides off, it's got to go somewhere.
Yeah.
So that impacts on the surrounding garden. And even though it may not be all there all the time, you've got rails sticking out into the garden. And I began to think, well, what about having a flip-off roof? And with the little Wendy house next door, the Wendy house has got a nice little A-frame roof.
Okay.
So I thought, if I make this thing an A-frame roof of the same shape, then it'll look quite neat.
Mm-hmm.
So that means I've got the A-frame and I flip the one side off to the one side of the building and the other side of the roof goes down
mm-hmm.
against the wall on the far side of the building. And, you know, then it really became a means of what I was going to use to actually make the roof. And eventually I've got what today is the equivalent of asbestos, but it's now actually made out of cement.
Okay.
So it's actually heavier than I thought it was.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to survive well, but it was actually quite a job getting it put up there and then working. How am I going to hinge the thing?
Mm-hmm.
How am I going to stop water getting in here, rainwater? And it took many, many experiments. And as you, Alan, will be able to see over here, this is part of the hook that I used to lever open the roof.
Okay.
So I'll give you a little demonstration afterwards of how the roof actually
does open. Yeah.
But it's not just simply a case of, right, try and put a hook on the end there and tilt it over. Because when you actually begin to try and implement that practically, you find, mm-hmm. oh, well, that doesn't work very well and that doesn't work. So it really took me about 4 months until I actually had a functional observatory as a building.
Right.
I'd put in a concrete pier. And, you know, there was the advice that concrete is not a very good idea because it resonates.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't found that at all. It's been sort of very sturdy. What I do have is a chain that goes from the wall, which I can actually hook onto the onto the mount.
Mm-hmm.
And I can just take up any tension over there with the chain against the wall.
Okay.
So if... And it just helps make it a little bit more stable if you sort of touch it. But even so, I'm amazed. What I often do with people who visitors are looking through, I just say, put your hand on the base
mm-hmm.
just to steady yourself.
Right.
With initially touching it, You do see the movement, but within 5-10 seconds, it's steadied.
Okay.
So
okay.
I'm very surprised.
I suppose so the weight of the chain so easily. Puts a bit of tension on it. It
puts a bit of tension
on it. And also chain. Damps out any...
Yeah.
Okay.
And so, you know, first light was probably around about March or April of 2016.
Mm-hmm.
But there was plenty else to do. I put a desk in here. I put a cupboard in here. And began to put all sort of nice bits and pieces in here, like a nice wall clock and
mm-hmm.
thermometer up on the wall, and yeah. notice board, and and to really make it feel like home. And then there was a heck of a diversion in April when instead of my 6-inch Celestron that was intended to live in here,
mm-hmm.
and I'm just going to take a quick break there, which is not to be edited out.
Yeah.
Because I used the word Celestron.
Uh-huh.
And Jack Bennett, of course, who was the discoverer of two lovely comets and amongst the top five comets of the 20th century,
mm-hmm.
And that was said by Patrick Moore.
Yeah.
And he's the fellow I went to get the keys from for the observatory.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to know him in the few years after that he... stayed alive, and he died in his early 70s, mainly from the effects of arthritis. And visiting him in his hospital bed one day and speaking about a Celestron, and he said, when I was invited over to the United States on receiving one of his awards
mm-hmm.
for his observing, and he was taken to the factory that actually made that brand of telescope.
Right.
And he spoke about Celestron. Mm-hmm. And they said to him, no, our name is Celestron.
Right, right.
So I've always remembered and called it Celestron.
Because when you say it like that, you can see why. It's
yes, you Celestron. Can see yes, why. Yeah. Exactly. So Celestron. So maybe people will learn now to say Celestron.
Yeah, well, we've been told, yeah.
not that it's important. But I saw an advertisement for a 10-inch Mead. There's a long story behind the 10-inch Mead, which we won't go into now, but I ended up buying this 10-inch Schmidt Cassegrain.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had various issues with it, with the drive motor, and it's a 30-year-old telescope, and so perhaps the gears were a little bit worn, but I've had quite a lot of work to do in replacing, because you just don't get those parts any longer.
Mm.
So it's really been a case of starting from scratch, finding a motor, finding a gearbox, finding them that would actually fit inside the current housing that I've got yes. here. And then the electronics that was driving the original motor, different motor speeds, different gear ratios, so I've had to change that electronics, and that's when I decided to go for an Arduino microprocessor.
Okay.
And I've had Arduino processors for a while and done one or two things with them, but I always wanted to have a real purpose to have an Arduino. So now my Arduino is running it, and of course I can do various other things. And one of the most important things, having experienced gears being graunched, was to actually have a routine in the program that will switch off the drive motor
mm-hmm.
half an hour after I've had a last button press on either in my east or west declination.
Okay.
So that completely, it resets the timer each time
mm-hmm.
that I press one of those and says, okay, from now I'll go another 30 minutes. If I close up and I've forgotten to switch off, half an hour later it will actually switch
okay.
it off. And I wanted to do other things as well, like record the start and stop of each observing session.
Mm-hmm.
Those are nice things you can do
yeah.
with having a computer controlling the telescope. So at the moment, it's in a bit of a Heath Robinson state because these cables that I'm showing mm-hmm. you, Alan, now are...
Yeah, I can see there's a fair bit
through
of
to the
home wiring. There's some ribbon cables. And
but once the software has been finalized...
Mm-hmm.
then I'm going to actually put it onto the small little matchbox size Arduino, and then that will actually fit inside the housing.
Okay. All right, it's interesting. I'm going to get some photographs of that, I think.
Okay.
Yeah.
Fine. So, and you know, I enjoy tinkering, and so I've added all sorts of bits and pieces to the setup over here, like my own method of having counterweights, and having to counterweight the actual tube itself, which can get very heavy when it's lying horizontally and it's got a camera on the one side together with the mirror. And so I have to tell myself that it's not, I mustn't be working on the observatory or on the telescope. I must actually be looking through the telescope.
Right, right.
I've got to make sure I do that as well. But I'm very keen. I've got all sorts of ideas for various programs that I want to get involved in, and things that I've become aware of through our club.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them was a talk by José da Silva on how you, from your backyard, can actually observe the transit of an exoplanet across the face of a star.
Okay.
Now, to me, this sounded absolutely impossible. I thought there must be some joke about this or some trick, but you can actually do that.
What sort of instrument do you need for that?
I'd use my scope. I think you possibly can use a 6-inch scope.
Okay.
But you have a little bit of software, and of course software makes so much possible these days, particularly photography, as you will know, the processing, which we can do now, is what one could never do in the old days of celluloid.
Yeah.
But it's a case of having predictions of where there is going, which star might be occulted or will be occulted, because they know, they've got predictions now when they expect an exoplanet to come around in front of a star. And so you aim your telescope, and I don't think it actually even needs a telescope, it's just the camera.
Right.
So you aim the camera at that area, and then you have it driven on a polar aligned drive so that it more or less stays in the field. It doesn't have to be perfectly aligned. And over a period of, say, 3 hours, where you would have the transit maybe taking 2 hours, it would start taking photographs before the actual transit starts. So it starts building up a picture of all the stars around in that area. It's an idea of how the light is changing during the time that you are over the 3 hours during which you're collecting these images, and then it knows which star it is, and then it will actually go and look specifically at how that star dims and eliminate all other sources of dimming.
Right, right.
By having this reference.
I see, in the background. Right, right.
And that way, then you pull out the data, and of course, it's not an easy dim. I don't think you'd see it visually, but statistically, looking at the brightness of the star, you will actually see the chart, and you would see a drop in the brightness of that star for the period at which that exoplanet was moving in front of it.
Will this work with a DSLR, or do you need a...
Yes, it will work with a DSLR. Exactly with a DSLR. Wow.
What software is this?
It's freely available software. It's enthusiasts, amateur, free software. So it's one of the things I'll be doing fairly soon.
Well, if you can find out what it's called, I can also put that in my notes, because I want to do that.
Well, I think so. Maybe what we should do is get Jose around here, and maybe we could actually record a discussion with Jose as well.
Yeah, it's a good idea, yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
So,
because I met him a couple of years ago. We captured an asteroid occultation. There was a few of us with Bosman and a couple of others. So I have met him, yeah. Okay, no, that'd be great.
Yeah. So, you know, that's a project I want to do. I want to have maybe a few variables that I keep watching. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my main aim is not to be a fantastic photographer. I do like to play with photography.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to be the best variable star observer. I don't want to be the best deep sky. What I want to do is just learn to know the sky a lot better than what I actually do know it.
Yeah.
And one of the ways to do that is to have projects.
Uh-huh.
And it's just lovely being out under the sky in any case. Mm. But that's really my main motivation for having an observatory, just to improve my familiarity and knowledge of the sky.
Mm. We've been talking for over an hour. If people want to get hold of you, if they want to chat to you or send you an email or find you on Facebook or what have you, where can they find you?
The best way is to go through to the Star Waders website,
mm-hmm.
which is very easy at starwaders.com.
Okay.
In the footer, I think, I'm pretty sure, there is an email address, info@starwaders.com.
Okay.
So you're welcome to contact me that way. I'm going to keep my cell phone number private. Uh-huh. But once you've maybe emailed me, I can give you my telephone number.
All right.
And you're welcome to phone me and chat about things. And if you're in Pretoria,
mm-hmm.
come and visit me at my observatory.
Fantastic. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Alan.